are listening to The Cooler Ring, a podcast made for manufacturing marketers. Here are Carmen Perry and Jeff White.
Welcome to The Cooler Ring, a podcast for manufacturing marketers brought to you by Cooler Partners. My name is Jeff White. Joining me today is Carmen Perry. Carmen, how you doing, mate?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
I've been looking forward to today's conversation. I think it's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, I think it's a unique topic and one we haven't covered, I don't think, in at least quite a number of years, talking about the notion of authenticity.
Yeah, and it seems almost like we hit the rewind button or something in the day of AI, and we're going to go back to Web 2.0 and talk about authenticity and brand voice like it was so popular back then.
Mm.
Like, it seemed like it was the first time when it was really being in digital marketing conversation ecosystem at large that you started hearing about this notion. Would you say?
I think that's accurate. And I think it was of a time because the internet before that was a lot more about anonymity. And whereas social and the notion of authenticity allowed maybe for people to finally feel like they could be themselves or that they had to be themselves, at least in some early social networks.
Yeah, maybe it was about, early on. It was also a bit about authority, I suppose, right? And then as things moved, a little democratization that we believed in at the time, whether or not it was true or not, we can save that debate for another day. But, yeah, interesting. And here we are, like, all is new again. But I do think it's interesting to think about how a brand communicates, the voice that shines through in its communication, and what that means for the commercial success of the enterprise.
Yeah, and for customers, employees, and everything else. So,
So
joining us today is Luke Wittenbreaker. Luke is the marketing and sales director at MacTech OnSite. Welcome to the Cooler Ring, Luke.
I'm happy to be here and happy to provide a little authenticity to the day.
Luke, it's awesome to have you on the show. Look, let's before we get too into the subject of the day, I'd love to tell our listeners a little bit more about MacTech OnSite. What do you folks do there?
MacTech OnSite is a field machining business. If you're listening to the show and you know what a machine shop does, they maketh metal into different things by removing chunkets of metal, as they say. We do that out in the field, on site, in a spot that you can't bring a piece of metal to a machine shop to have it worked on. So whether you're milling or cutting pipe or beveling or drilling or something into a structure, we have portable field machining equipment, sometimes called on-site machining, that we take to site and use there to make something useful.
Got it. What are your customers mostly? Like, what industries are you serving?
Well, that's a great question. I always call it a broad niche because we have a very broad base of customers, shipbuilding, space, power gen, oil and gas, refining, power plants, manufacturing. My dear old dad once told me, and someone probably told him, anything you see driving by with a smokestack or a steam stack outside of it, there's something to be machined in there that they can't bring to a machine shop. So go knock on that door. I say broad niche because within this big broad group of industries, it's usually a very specialized situation, right? Mm. So on a big ship, we are machining a rudder shaft to a rudder bore to put a shaft into for steering linkages or the propeller shaft or the rudder. In the space industry, we're working on launch platforms and things like that. In the refining industry, they got big moving parts that need to work well and they wear out and you have to rebore holes and remill platforms to set a vibrating engine on or whatever it is. So it's interesting. We make the world move forward at times by machining one thing at a time.
Very cool, Luke. And you had mentioned your dad, so I just want to highlight a family business, and you're second generation in it, yeah?
Second generation, yes, sir. 40 years young this year, and I've been working for the business for 15 or 16 of those.
All right.
I said I don't always know the exact number because I'd go make $10 an hour painting boxes, random summers and things like that. So I didn't start there, but I'm there now in my career path, and my dad and I are still working together and having fun doing it. And that's probably the most important part to me. So here I am.
Nice.
That's really nice. Cool. How long was your dad in it before you joined?
He has been there 40 years, but he is not the founder. He moved us up from Texas to Minnesota to help the founder. I'm air quoting for people that can't watch me. Help the founder kind of, he was struggling and needed a consultant to come up there. And it was supposed to be a little 1 year, 2 year turnaround. And 40 years later, he owns the business and is still enjoying working in it. So it was fun.
All right. So with that background, let's start peeling back what it means to have a brand voice that's a bit more authentic. And man, I mean, you work in a space that I'd just say, I think it's fair to say, it just isn't probably not a lot of bullshit in it, right? I mean, this is where we're talking about real work that needs to get done and real people that come and do it. There's not a lot of room for BS along the way in some way. So you think, okay, well, I can understand what you mean when you're saying more authentic, but then again, if the whole category operates that way, then we're talking about something that's slightly different again. So what do you mean when you say you bring a more authentic brand tone or brand voice, and how does it differ from others in your space, in your view?
Well, maybe there is a little bullshit in our authentic brand voice, because one of the things I constantly think of, and it's just a simple, easy, low-hanging fruit, is just listening to how people talk. There's a lot of blue-collar guys in our industry, right? Like, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. And listening to how those people talk and give each other direction and tell each other to lift that effing thing up or whatever it might be, it's not like I sit there and put curse words in every marketing piece we do, but you got to listen to how your team and customer base talk and give direction to each other and solve problems and translate that into how people speak to each other. I mean, different sports teams speak to each other in different languages of sorts when they're out on the field. And I try to capture that and recognize it. And these blue collar guys that might see an ad or a brochure or a marketing piece also just kind of see through that BS. And if it's just corporate jargon that is force fed into them, I don't see them liking it.
I have to imagine, though, that, I mean, in those spaces, whether you're talking about shipbuilding or oil and gas or power generation, you're not, the people signing the checks may not be the people who are the gruff ones on the line that are working with your team that are coming out to help machine something on site. So you're probably also having to deal with procurement departments or head offices, oh, yes, and things like that. So how do you bridge that divide between the folks who experience what MacTech does for them every day versus, right, those that you're kind of also selling to?
Like, kind of how does the authenticity come to life in both, yeah, places?
Both, yeah, ends. I mean, the easiest way to talk about that is we try to create our buyer personas for, whether it's by accounts or by industry. And we know the people at the shipyards that are cutting checks or sitting in an office and more white collar than the guy working down on the floor. But as a marketer, I don't try to alienate any of those, but I do try to think of who is influencing that decision more than who is making that final decision. If I'm buying something for my organization, my president or CFO might make that final decision to buy a $200,000 overhead crane. We recently did that. Here's a true story. But the guys that are going to be using that crane are the guys that are going to be pulling the spec sheet, looking at it, saying, yeah, that's what I need. Now I want to get budget approval for the most part. But I agree with you, both of you, that you don't want to alienate CFO Dave with curse words in your brochure or something, because he's the one, getting it and signing off on the final check. So we do think about our content on many levels, but I try to think about who makes the most influence in a decision for the most part.
In thinking about this conversation, I was it's like, you know, it occurred to me that it's almost in some ways people, like brands that tend to lean into this, being a bit more themselves in the market. Sometimes I find it, if you will, takes two different angles. One is sometimes they'll talk about things that their competitors won't talk about.
Sure.
And then they'll talk about it in a different, talk about things in a different way that their competitors won't.
Right.
How does that balance play out for MacTech?
I think it's important that the balance plays out with how much of, I think much of your culture you get into your authenticity as well. I mean, whatever you want to call that at whatever organization you're at, I think people, companies, organizations, from the CFO to the guy on the floor buying that crane, make decisions and do business. You know, people say people do business with people they like or are like-minded to. Not that the product itself is secondary to that, but if you like someone and say, hey, our core values align with MacTech's core values, that's interesting. That's a immediate win. Let me take a closer look at that product.
And that's the crux of the question. I'm wondering how much is it about the type of thing you're talking about or how much is it is just simply the way you talk? It sounds as though it's more about the how than it is about the what.
I think it's about the how. We sell product and service that other companies do. We take even more pride in our expertise from experience. The fact that our field technicians are the one maintaining this equipment, putting it in boxes, sending it to a customer. We rent equipment. So if our guys are the same users that are sending a really solid piece of equipment out to a customer, they trust that equipment because they would take it out to site with them. And we try to, you know, you could say that about a piece of equipment, or you could say it about a company that truly cares about performance and reducing downtime and saving time and saving money and making sure you have the right spare parts when you get there, because our guys have lived those days where something shows up and a widget is missing so they can't run the machine and you got to fast track UPS something to site overnight or something. Mm-hmm. So we try to take that expertise from experience and share that with the customer. And because of that, we write about that a lot as something that makes us unique and special as compared to someone, a competitor that might sell a very similar size, shape, priced machine.
It almost sounds like you're recruiting from these sorts of places as well, and that your team that is delivering the service, I guess, is embodying that because they know it. You know, they've done it before themselves, they have the expertise, and that shines through. I mean, that's a put your money where your mouth is play for sure. How are you communicating this from a marketing perspective? Like what sorts of things are you putting out in the world to get this message across?
I have graduated to everybody, what we talked at the beginning, circle back about how the internet kind of used to be, and everybody's recommendation used to be, well, create a case study and go write some 5-page case study and gate it or don't gate it and get customers interested in how that case study saves you money. I've become a huge, I don't even know what to call it, but I've become a very big fan of just like short, punchy job stories. Like it's case study light, like Miller Lite, I guess. Or Busch Light, if you're a film machinist, because they drink that a lot. There we go. Authenticity. 500 words. What was the problem? What was the solution? What were the ingredients MacTech used to solve the problem? And why did it solve it? It's as simple as that. And it's pushed out on LinkedIn and Facebook and Instagram. And you know, I don't think you have to go as, and maybe it's just my industry. I don't have to go as deep as I feel like I used to in this world. It's like, just tell me a quick story that has a couple of cool pictures and write about how you help someone relieve some pain on site and the outcome of the job, and we're good to go. And I think we get great interaction with those. We get people sharing them. We get customers saying, oh, I do that on my in my facility. I'd like to know more. I'd like to get a quote on this. I mean, works for lead generation if you can capture those little stories and share them. And I'm getting too far into the weeds, but we're fortunate that for like the last 10 years, we created a new CRM and tracked right down and posted our scope of work, which is what the salesperson asked the customer they needed to solve. What do you want to do in your kitchen or whatever it is? And then our operations guys documented what tools, people, et cetera, was necessary to solve the problem, and it's called a recommendation. And so now I've got 10 years of, like, especially with the influx of AI and like pulling things together, I've got 10 years of job stories that are just like, here's the problem that needed to be solved. Here's the solution we chose. Add some of those core values and flavors and expertise from experience and quality people and culture, and put some lipstick on it, and you're ready to rock.
The thing I really like about that versus the case examples that tend to be very involved is that, well, frankly, from a creating them perspective, it's quite nice and a lighter lift, and that's everybody loves that. But the thing I find that you end up fighting as you try to create those more in-depth case examples is you're really trying to show how different people can take either inspiration or know-how or knowledge or what have you from the case. Like, you're trying to, I find that sometimes people can get into a place where they're almost in some way selling too hard or trying to explain too much or trying to give too much of a background rather than just say what happened. And I think there's something about that shorter format and the implicit kind of promise that you're going to be sharing more of them, that people kind of understand, okay, I don't have to try to get all the answers from this one piece of content. There's lots of it here. I think it creates a better dynamic. I don't know. I think there's more a marketing wisdom in what you're suggesting, Luke, than you're maybe giving it credit for.
Right. And I think about it too, towards like, we've become a society, even as, you know, everybody thinks of it as like the young people of our generation, even the older gentlemen, such as my father, I'll call him out. We become a society that swipes, right? Like, we swipe to date, we swipe to TikTok, we swipe on Instagram. And you have to like think about fitting your voice into that swipe before you get swiped right. And if I'm talking about dating apps, I mean, isn't going out and searching for customers kind of like going out and I've never used the dating app, by the way, but I've been married too long, which I guess is a good thing. But it is, you're trying to date your customers and you're trying to impress them with the first short. You got one, sometimes you have one chance to show them the corn and show them a good story or show them that really like resonates with them so that they click on you or swipe left or whatever it is and start a conversation.
Luke, I'm sorry, but Jeff made me promise that I'm not allowed to use dating as a...
There's a reason for this.
As a way of talking about marketing and sales ever again after the incident.
Yeah, there was a bit of it. Yeah, no, it's that. It's you just have to be really careful where you use the analogy of sex before marriage with certain people in certain areas. Yeah,
no, we didn't identify the persona correctly as what Jeff was trying to say in a particular sales call that may or may not have happened somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 8 years ago, and the scars are still there.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Know your audience.
Speaking of knowing your audience, do you take a different approach by vertical? Because you do serve a very wide range, and do you find that, Like we live by the notion here, it'll quote, be yourself, everyone else is already taken. I kind of get a sense that that's what you're trying to do.
right,
at MacTech, is just kind of be yourself as you're out in the market. So I guess, weird question, do you feel that there's some verticals where you can be more yourself than others? Are there other, you know, you're talking about space versus oil and gas. They're very different. So I just wonder, do you have to, do you mind your tone a little differently in some verticals than others? Or are you just like, no, this is just the way we are and this is what it is?
No, I started with cursing, but that's, I don't want to get stuck on there because I'm not afraid to throw out a BS or a damn or a F yeah every once in a while, which I'm censoring myself on this podcast. So I don't know what I'm doing now. But I think it just comes down to authenticity and how people make decisions. And like you said, the space industry has a lot of engineers in it that are looking for portable equipment to face a big flange on a rocket or whatever they're doing. And those people are different than a roughneck in the oil and gas industry that are cutting well heads off and plugging and abandoning wells. But you're exactly right. We're actually doing it right now with the shipbuilding industry. We're running kind of this internal voice ABM marketing campaign of called Make Ship Happen, which is kind of an authentic play on an old adage. But, you know, the USA is focused on building more ships and building them faster, and both for defense and commercial use. And so there's a lot of people out there have been building and maintaining ships for a long time, and we're one of them. And what we're doing right now is calling 6 or 7 of our favorite customers and asking them 8 to 10 very specific questions and figuring out what keeps them up at night and what brings them pain and what's the worst experience they've had and what the best experience they've had, and take that and translate it into, just like you're saying, a way of messaging people like them that aren't them that could be new potential customers.
Yeah, having my job previous to starting this agency was working at a shipbuilding design company out here on the East Coast that does Canada's naval design and development. So I know the type of company you're talking about. I can certainly see that kind of way of interacting really playing to what they look for and the kind of culture that they have. I want to go back to something you talked about a few moments ago around this house-built CRM, this custom CRM, and how you're defining that, almost like that attribution curve for the types of content, sorts of questions that were asked in the sales process. It, by the sounds of things, you've been doing that for a while, and getting a sales team to engage with a CRM at all can be difficult. How have you found getting that level of compliance with your sales team to be as an effort overall to ensure that you have that good data in your CRM?
Isn't that like a wholly separate 1-hour podcast to explain that away?
Look, I like that he tried to just wiggle that in right at like the 20-some-odd minute. I'm liking it.
It goes a long way. We have a good, I'd call them good to great sales team. It doesn't always come easy. Sometimes it takes reminding people 7 times to do things before it truly catches on. But I mean, we, 10 years ago, we were running on spreadsheets and like basically no CRM. And I said, it's time to do something about it. And we created the environment within the software that we knew we needed to follow our sales process. And it was just basically stating, if it's not in the CRM, then it doesn't exist. Like I can't have operations give you a recommendation. I can't fulfill a patching list. I can't invoice it if it's not in there. And then if I can't invoice it, I can't make the customer pay for it, and you can't collect your commission check. So there's the real, you get your sales team going.
The ultimate incentive.
Look, if we're going to be authentic, we may as well just call it like it is. And I was like, I'm sitting here listening to the response. I'm like, when are we getting to the money?
There's the money.
Follow the money. Anything in life. You know, sometimes these authentic marketing pieces, though, grow organically. When I started the CRM, it was never my intention to pull job stories out of it. That just sort of happened. And I think it happened because we turn in pictures from jobs to share. Like I have a incentive program for our field techs to turn in pictures. And when I get one, it usually has a job number on it. And one day I was just like, oh, I'll just take that job number and look at CRM, what we did. And all of a sudden it was like, oh, well, the story is, I don't have to go call someone and ask them, spend 30 minutes talking to someone to figure out what went on, what happened on this job. Cause I've got all the preamble and what happened and what we did to succeed kind of right here in the database.
That's pretty awesome.
That is awesome. I honestly, I've never heard of somebody using a that direct kind of CRM to case study kind of workflow in quite the same way. We're near 400 episodes on of the Cooler Ring, I got to say.
There you go.
That's very cool. Luke, I wonder, staying on the topic of surprises as we bring the podcast to a close. Well, it occurred to me, I mean, you have a strong history in the business, clearly, and more connected to it than most. What's been your biggest surprise in the marketing and sales role that you have?
My biggest surprise, it's a good question. I would say my biggest surprise is that when I've figured out as a marketer what not to work on was actually like the biggest lever/unlock of ability and power there could be for a young or middle-aged marketer. For the longest time at MacTech and other places, you try to cast such a wide net and a wide, again, kind of back to our broad niche audience. It was like, okay, we have 30 different industries we work for and 200 different tools, when you can really just cast things aside and focus on what's important, it just unlocks your ability to make great shit. Hmm. Yeah, I told you I'd curse on here.
So you're saying is that as a marketer in your early days, you felt like you just got distracted, like you're kind of playing whack-a-mole too much, trying to do too many things?
Or trying to, if you try to market to 30 different industries, you probably could do it, especially now with AI tools and help. But if you just say, okay, in 2026, we're going after shipyards, space, the civil cutting market and the nuclear decommissioning market. All right, I know I'm going to go interview 5 customers in each of those markets. I'm going to create a template approach to define our process to go attack those 4 markets with 80% of my resources and time, and the other 20% gets sprinkled on top of the 6 other market.
So, yeah, focus. Yeah. I'm fond of saying that as time goes on, it's only getting worse. The amount of things competing for attention, that marketing whack-a-mole, competing for attention, budget, everything, it's almost limitless. And never been more important to measure twice and cut once, as it were.
Right. I think I had a post about that the other day.
at least you can, you know.
Yeah. My biggest, recent marketing unlock, and maybe it was just like a warning flare to myself, is that now almost everybody's got some form of AI tool they use, and I'm using it, and I've spent a lot of time, you know, thinking about authenticity. I've spent a lot of time with Mac, who I named, or actually he named himself, he's my ChatGPT helper, and Mac and I have spent a lot of time so that he knows what we want to sound like in my voice, and knows our marketing plan and knows my authentic voice. And he's helped, even with these small stories, he started churning out stuff for me, and I don't just publish it. I proofread it and I get it out there and I push it out, and I'm like, yes, this does sound like me. And then I'll read someone else's post in a completely different industry about something completely different, and I'm kind of like, man, that post kind of sounds like the authentic post I posted about what I do. So it's almost like you're getting coached into this groupthink of how you should write, but it's also someone else that is artificial intelligence sort of speaking to you, and you just, you can't get caught up in just smashing the yes button and pushing it. You have to question and think about how you would really write something and how your voice really sounds.
Yes, a lot of people are navigating that right now. People have gotten past the point of, oh my God, I can now write a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And then it's getting to the point of, just because I can, should I? And what else should we do with this to make sure it's actually valuable? But look, Luke, this has been great. I think we could go on for another half hour, especially if we wanted to explore Jeff's how do you get salesperson compliance question in more detail. But I thank you for joining the Cooler Ring. It's been a really great conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, cheers. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to The Cooler Ring with Carmen Perry and Jeff White. Don't miss a single manufacturing marketing insight. Subscribe now at kulapartners.com/thecoolerring. That's KULA partners.com/thecoolerring.